Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. We have in studio the webmaster for Creation Research Society. They're tremendous guys. He has his own website, evolutionfairytale.com. He's a creation speaker. His name is Fred Williams. Fred, welcome to the show.
Bob, it's great to be back for another edition of Real Science Friday, as opposed to Science Friday that PBS does.
That's right, that NPR radio show in America where it's mostly science fiction. Fred, you're a software engineer, technical background, and what a great time to talk about the Creation Magazine, which is what we're going to do. This comes out quarterly. People could get it online at creationontheweb.com. It's a full-color, fabulous magazine. And let's dig right into some of the science in this Creation Magazine, the current edition, December through February 2008.
Great. Okay, Bob, let's talk about the amazing abalone armor. It's a shellfish that Jonathan Sarfati wrote about. Now, Jonathan Sarfati is one of the leading creation scientists in the world. He's also a renowned chess player. I think he was a New Zealand chess champion. And I was at a creation conference where Sarfati was one of the guest speakers, and at night when we were all kind of fellowshipping, and it was a big group of people, he would play five guys blindfolded at chess. And
wait, five guys at the same time, but blindfolded.
Yeah, five guys at the same time blindfolded with his back turned towards them, and then there would be an MC that would, you know, read off the moves that these guys were making, and it was just fun to watch because he slaughtered them all. I think one guy out of, I think, 20, I think he did this four times over the course of two nights. One guy was able to bring him to a draw, but the one moment I remember was a friend of mine, Pete Fisk. In fact, he's been a guest on your show. His son was playing Sarfati and had taken his queen. And I'll never forget Sarfati's, his expression after that happened. He just kind of goes, huh.
Wait, but he won.
Yeah, but Sarfati came back and slaughtered him. But it was just interesting that Pete's son was able to take his queen. But
you know,
it was
way
fun
back,
to watch.
Fred, way back in the 70s, I fell in love with chess as a high school student, and I wanted to see if I could get good at it. So I looked up an international grandmaster lived in New York, Samuel Reshevsky, and he played Bobby Fischer, and Bobby Fischer included two of those games in his book, My 60 Most Memorable Games, and I took lessons for some months, and I asked Samuel Reshevsky, I asked, do you think I have potential? And he said, no. And so I ended. You know, back then it was like $60 an hour. That was in the 70s. And I still love chess, and I've tried playing blindfolded with my kids. Our kids learn chess when they're 3-4 years old and on up. They love it. And I could get about 30 moves in, and then I can't do it anymore. So, boy.
And he did this against five people at the same time.
That is so cool. And this article about these abalone shellfish, which are edible, and some people say we shouldn't eat animals, and then we ask, well, then why did God make them out of meat? You know, if we're not supposed to eat them.
Well, you know, people for ethical treatment of animals, I think, you know, we like to call it people for eating tasty animals.
Yeah, that's right, PETA. And, you know, why did God make them out of meat if he didn't want us to eat them? Then I love animals. They're delicious. But anyway, these abalones, they're shellfish, edible, and beautiful colors. And we've been to New Zealand. 10 of us went there when Bill Clinton went there to protest. You know, he's such a wicked, immoral leader, and he was being honored. So we wanted to go and give a Christian testimony that you don't honor the wicked for their wickedness. But anyway, the native peoples of New Zealand, the Maori, they take these shellfish and they make these beautiful jewelry out of them. Well, it turns out that scientists, like at universities around the world, are studying these abalones, like at the University of California, because they find out that it is so strong, and they're mostly made out of calcium carbonate, which means they shouldn't be so strong. But what they did was they took thin glass slides, and they inserted them into the shells as they're growing. And they find out that they assemble themselves in such a sophisticated way that they become way more tough, way more strength than they could if they were pure calcium carbonate. And so you've got this research going on, and I'd like to read just a couple short quotes. Like a material scientist at the University of Washington said, nature has designed, and they always have to say evolution, right? Nature has designed an interface of organic and inorganic materials interpenetrating in ways that we cannot yet equal. That's pretty cool, right? And Jonathan Sarfati says, well, this is the compulsory homage they have to pay to evolution whenever they write anything.
And, of course, they never, like he goes on to say, they never provide any specifics of how evolution could do this vastly complex design. They like to throw in words like simple and this and that, and, you know, those are just that's really illusion. They love to play with words, simple, primitive. They give you the illusion of evolution, but they don't explain to you, you know, what's really going on.
Yeah.
And these things aren't so simple after all.
Right. We think these shellfish are like, you know, how could you get more simple? Well, Jonathan Sarfati quotes the researchers who analyzed the making of the shell, and this is what they said. Even the simplest bio-induced structures are currently impossible to synthesize. And that was in Material Science and Engineering, a quote from 2005. That's just too cool.
Well, the engineering is always incredible that's done by our creator, and we're always trying to copy it, and we can never get anywhere close to the magnificent design that we see.
Exactly. And so, Fred, I think going from Jonathan's article to a small blurb they have at the beginning of the magazine in their focus section on coral, because evolutionists forever have said coral, you know, they're very primitive, they're very simple. Yeah. Simple? Coral reefs? Well, let's remind the listeners that we're talking through the current issue of Creation Magazine, and what a great magazine it is, full color. Now, you could get it yourself. You could go online and subscribe, or to help Bob and Art Live stay on the air and to subsidize these Real Science Friday shows that Fred Williams and I do, you have two choices if you'd like us to get you a subscription. You could purchase our Bob and Art Live BEL Science Pack that has great DVDs, science books, a debate we did on the age of the Earth with a geophysicist and a mathematician from CU up in Boulder. So that costs $100, and then we'll give you a gift subscription of Creation Magazine. You get 1 year. It's a quarterly, four-color, beautiful publication. Or if you make a donation to Bob and Art Live, it's non-deductible, but a $50 or more donation, and if you ask for a subscription to Creation Magazine, we'll do that. We'll contact them and set your subscription up for you. Or you could go directly to creationontheweb.com. And you could sign up there. And, of course, that would save you money. So you might want to do that.
It's a very interesting magazine, very well written for the layman. And, you know, I can't more than recommend it. It's got a section for children. It's just a great magazine.
Yeah, and every page is a work of art with the photos and the graphics. It's just great. So, Fred, how about coral? We talk about the coral reef. We hear a lot about that. Coral is simple, evolutionarily speaking?
Yeah, well, you know what they're finding out is they may have more genes than humans.
Yeah, and we're so simple, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Right. How many genes have they found so far in coral?
Well, they've already found 10,000 genes. They think they could ultimately find as many as 20,000.
So they're plumbing the genome of coral, and they're finding out that it is wildly complex. And, you know, when they talk about 10,000 genes, it's still hard to define a gene. You know, a gene could be a region of the DNA that codes for a protein. But genes are so wildly complex, and you have so many levels of information interacting simultaneously in our DNA that it blows our minds. Things that they thought were junk DNA for the last 20 years, they're saying, hey, that's not junk at all. That's really vital stuff. And we're just beginning to comprehend. It's like there are operating systems that interact, and the genes are like variables, you know, and you got local and global variables, and how does it all
exactly
work?
Exactly, just like a computer program in many ways. And now they're discovering functions of microRNA And, you know, these things are, you know, they're regulating genes. They're, you know, turning off and on proteins. It's detecting proteins that are bad that maybe got mutated and they got to throw out that we've talked about on a prior show. This is all stuff that 10 years ago they were saying was junk, and now they're finding a function for it. So more and more we're finding more complexity right. in the genome.
I got to debate Dr. Eugenie Scott about a decade ago, and I asked her. It was a one-hour debate. She's one of the world's leading scientist. She's a physical anthropologist who is full-time against creation. That's her gig. And so I asked her, well, give me two or three of your best pieces of evidence that higher functions evolve, like eyesight, hearing, radar location, mobility, whatever. Give me your best evidence. So she would not give any through almost the whole show. Toward the end of the show, she finally gave her best evidence was junk DNA. And I responded, Eugenie, you know, we're just beginning to understand genetics. And she said, oh, no, we've learned most of what there is to know. This is back in the mid-90s. And I said, okay, I'm writing this down, the date, the time. We have this. We sell the DVD, Bob Debates an Evolutionary Scientist. So I'm writing down the day, the time, when Eugenie Scott. And I said, Eugenie, I want to give you a chance to take that back because that's just too funny. And now here we are a decade later, and – scientists, evolutionists are saying we no longer can call it junk because it has vital functions.
And what that does, too, it pushes the difference between chimps and humans farther than the 98% that they try to tell us and, you know, they preach in the public schools. Even 98% is a problem for evolution that is probably too technical right now to get into. But now we're finding that because of these regions of the DNA that they thought were junk are now functional. The differences between chimps and humans is now coming in between 89% and 95%, which is way too many differences for us to have a common ancestor. It's not mathematically possible.
And even with 1%, since there's 3 billion base pairs in the human DNA on that double helix, well, then evolutionists believe that we evolved away from the chimps and primates back a few million years ago. So you have millions of mutations that have to occur in the span of a few million years, and we're told that evolution happens so slowly you can't see it, and it takes thousands of generations to get one change to permeate through an entire species around the globe, and we need millions of changes to happen over millions of years through the entire human genome. Come on, give me a break.
That's right, because 3 billion nucleotides in the human genome, 1% of that is 30 million.
Yeah.
The math isn't that difficult. In fact, evolutionist mathematicians have shown that you can only get about 1,600 changes if you assume 10 million years and a generation of 20 years. You could maybe get 1,600 changes between our common ancestor and us, 1,600 beneficial changes. It's called Haldane's dilemma.
And now you just said 1% is 30 million. That's of each nucleotide. Of course, a gene, a region that codes for a protein, a regulatory, whatever, that's made up of a number of nucleotides.
Exactly.
So, you know, 1% of the number of genes is a different number, a smaller number, but it is a mathematical problem that evolutionists have. It happens too slowly to see, but so quickly that you can't get here from there. Okay. So anyway, the coral is wildly complex. Evolutionists have long considered coral to be a simple animal, but the researchers, and this was in ABC News Online in April 2007, the researchers are saying that the genetic complexity challenges the notion that life started out simple, then evolved to become more sophisticated, and they're finding out, and this example blows my mind, I love it, I love God, how he created. And it confounds the wise.
Oh, he always thwarts the naturalistic explanation.
He does. Coral, they share many genes with humans, including the genes involved with the immune system. So now what do evolutionists think? They think we evolved from coral?
Well, I've never really heard someone tell me that I look like a coral. I have had people tell me I look like a monkey sometimes or act like one, but I never hear my wife say I act like a coral.
So the genes involved in the development of the immune system, they predate an ancestor before coral evolved and before humans evolved. It's all so inane, but of course it is inane. So I don't know, did Hillary evolve from a monkey and Fred Thompson evolve from I don't know.
Well, you know, Bob, it's funny you mention that because the very next page it has some silly evolution storytelling. Hmm. For example, this one's funny. Girls prefer pink because of evolution. Back in hunter-gatherer days, women would have benefited from being able to home in on ripe red fruits. So, Bob, if that's true, do you think men liked blueberries since we like the color blue?
We like blue. Women like pink.
So we must have gathered blueberries back when we were cave ape men.
Now, they got to be joking here. No, these are evolutionists and examples from, you know, major news sources like the BBC, ABC News, and so on. And why do women like pink? Because girls were collecting back thousands of years ago looking for red ripe fruits. So they evolved to like pink. And you're pointing out, well, guys like blue, so what did we do?
And it goes on to say in the next bullet item that they mastered the art, and so that's why they are born to shop.
Yeah, women are born to shop, right. And, you know, my family, we went to an amusement park, and it was amazing. We were looking at the little kids there, and there were girls. There must have been 5,000 girls under the age of 10 at this park. And they were all in pink. Not all, but like 90% of the little girls. We have 7 boys, you know, so we don't have anything pink in our whole house. But it seemed like 90% had pink on. And girls love pink, you know, and God made them male and female. And we are different. And those differences challenge the feminist and the evolutionist and the atheist. The feminists don't like it when girls play with dolls and boys play with trucks and shovels. It's so funny. We were at a friend's house, and they had only girls, so they had Barbie dolls. So my kids pick up the Barbie dolls, and they sort of turn the doll into the shape of a machine gun. Yeah. They're shooting it. They're shooting, you know, make-believe enemies with the Barbie doll. And so, no, girls and boys, they're different. God made them male and female.
Exactly.
That's just so cool. Well, speaking of evolutionary storytelling, there's a story in here about lizards, which is pretty hysterical. And the evolutionists, and these are evolutionists from Harvard, and if I understand it right, Harvard, they're supposed to have some pretty sharp people there, aren't they?
That's the rumor.
That's the rumor. Well, they did some evolutionary research. They thought, you know, there are a lot of islands in the Caribbean that have lizards on them, so let's have an excuse to hang out in the Caribbean, right? So they devised this experiment where they would take larger lizards that were predators that would eat smaller lizards, and they took 12 islands, and on 6, they left them just as is. And on the other 6, they introduced this larger predator lizard to see what would happen. And 6 months later, there are headlines around the world, leggy lizards evolving and fast forward, short legs win evolution battle, quick evolution at work. The whole world, Harvard is telling the whole world that evolution worked in 6 months. What happened? What did they do?
Well, this is really an illusion that you hear a lot of. They try to take a small-scale change, what we call microevolution, or in another case, natural selection, and they try to say that natural selection is evolution. Well, natural selection is something the creationists have always espoused, and all that happened here, Bob, was this mean lizard-eating lizard ate all the slow lizards.
So the lizard ate the lizards who couldn't run so fast.
Yeah, that's right. And this, you know, they call this evolution, and really all it was really loss of genes. I mean, the gene pool for the lizards is now dropped. If it was successful, we'll find out in the story that they weren't successful in killing off all the short-legged lizards. But let's say they were. If they were, then really what this is de-evolution, because now you don't have any more gene capability for short legs.
Well, Fred, you and I live in Colorado, the Rocky Mountains, and I go hiking a lot with our friends and family. If you and I were hiking and a mountain lion came out after us, a mountain lion, would I have to outrun the mountain lion to survive?
Not necessarily.
No, I just have to outrun you.
That's true.
So you would get you.
That's right. Natural. I would have been naturally selected.
That's
just
right.
Like the unicorn came up the arc right before the tiger, and it was naturally selected.
Yeah,
naturally
right.
Selected.
Right, right. For dinner. So here we have the larger lizards would get hungry, and so they would chase the smaller lizards. And the one with shorter legs couldn't run as fast, so he'd eat them.
Yeah, so after 6 months, their population had dwindled quite a bit. Well, what was interesting that this article points out that probably didn't make the world headlines was 6 months later, the short-legged lizards' populations started to regrow because they were better climbers.
Right. All the smaller lizards realized that life is rough on the ground, and they started to climb the trees to get away from the larger lizards. Well, that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
And so they're up in the trees, and the longer-legged lizards had a hard time climbing. So the predator would then start eating the longer-legged lizards. So a year after they started this vacation, this excuse to vacation in the Caribbean, a year later, it turns out the populations were the same as when they started. No difference. And so what's happening is there's no evolution occurring whatsoever. Is there any increase in the genetic information?
No, if anything, in this case, it stayed the same. But if all the short-legged lizards have been killed, again, that genetic information would have been lost for short legs. But, you know, really all they do is they try to interchange the words natural selection with evolution to try to prove evolution is true. But really, this turns out to be evidence for creation because it shows how rapidly species can adapt to a changing environment. And so the animals that came off the ark, we know that there's a lot of genetic variability that accounts for this. Mm-hmm. You know, I get people will ask me about articles like this that they see in for example, the Rocky Mountain News reported on this, and I had somebody ask me at a conference, well, how do you explain these lizards, you know, evolving on these islands? And you have to ask the question, is the lizard still a lizard?
Is it still a lizard? Has it gained any new genes? Are there new genes, new proteins, new functionality? The lizard didn't change squat.
It didn't.
Not at all. No change whatsoever. There are still longer leg lizards and shorter leg lizards.
You just had some unlucky ones that didn't run as fast, Bob outrunning me.
Yeah, if the Germans succeeded in killing all the Jews in the world, every last Jew, would that have been evolution? It's not evolution. They've just killed off, you know, a precious treasure of the world, part of the human race, and they were murderers, and there's a loss of some of the genetic diversity in the gene pool, but that's not evolution. You need an increase, and evolutionists are so desperate that when a disease happens, they call that evolution.
Oh, I can't believe how often I've heard an evolutionist use cancer, for example, as an evidence of evolution.
Right,
but,
exactly.
Bob, something I want to touch on in this article is a lot of scientific publications wrote about this article, and this is some of the stuff that's being taught to our kids. I want to give you, for example, Time magazine. These changes occurred within a single generation, showing how the effects of natural selection can play out very quickly. Well, that's a true statement. But in the very same magazine, it also says, in the first 6 months, the brown anole developed longer legs so that it could outrun its predator. Did it really develop longer legs, Bob?
No,
it didn't develop longer legs. That's misleading. Yeah, this is what they're teaching our kids. It's an illusion.
Here's what we know. You know, if you kill a certain part of the population, another part, now the ratio is different. Also, fish. There are fish in a lake where there's no predator, and they will have fewer eggs when they become pregnant. The females, they lay fewer eggs, and those eggs take longer to mature. But if you introduce a predator, within one generation, they lay a greater number of eggs, and those eggs mature more rapidly. Then you get rid of the predator, it goes back. That's not Darwinian evolution, where over 1,000 generations, they're by random chance adapting to the environment. That is pre-programmed response to the environment that's in the DNA. The DNA is expressing that creative design adaptation to the environment. So that's far from evolution. And in this article here in Creation Magazine, Lizard Losers and Winners, they have a quote. And these headlines are from the New Scientist 2006. And here's a quote from Science Magazine in November 2006. They said, had we waited 12 months to first measure selection, we could have concluded that the predator's presence had little, if any, effect on selection because everything went back to a homeostasis, an equilibrium.
That's right. So, you know, don't be fooled by these words that there's quick evolutionary change occurring on these islands. It's just natural selection. It's misleading for them to claim that this is evidence of evolution. Very misleading.
Exactly right. Now, we only have a few more minutes. Maybe we could do one last story here. Fred, how about the story about you shouldn't marry your brother or sister? You know, the Drudge Report had an article just in this last week about twins who were separated at birth in England, and they grew up without knowing each other. They met as adults, and they married. Then they found out that they were twins, their brother and sister, and so they applied to a high court in Britain, and they were granted an annulment, because we know that if close relatives marry, it's tragic, because what happens is your children have a very high rate of likelihood of birth defects or even infant mortality.
Yeah, so over time, our human population is building up what's called a genetic load. So slowly, each generation, we're taking in more mutations. So the closer relation you are with somebody, your odds increase that you could get the same copy of the gene that's mutated. Mm-hmm. God built a wonderful redundancy system, and engineering redundancy is very important. Built this great redundancy system so that if one of these genes is mutated,
if your mom
harmful,
or your dad have a mutation.
That's right. If either one has a mutation, you've still got a good copy of the gene. But if you marry a close relative, then the odds increase that you're going to have the same gene from both parents, and then that trait's going to manifest itself, that harmful trait, in whatever the case may be, whatever the deformity is. They go up rapidly. And what's interesting about this whole article, Bob, it answers probably the most commonly asked questions by both skeptics and Christians alike, is where did Cain get his wife?
Where did Cain? Adam and Eve had Cain and Abel. Cain murdered Abel. Then where did Cain get his wife? Well, God created Adam and Eve genetically perfect.
Yeah, they would have had no genetic load, so incest, close relations, would not have been a problem. In fact, God did not outlaw incest until when?
Moses, 2,000 years later, when Adam sinned, he brought death and decay into the world. And so each generation, the mutations would collect. And so by the time of Moses, God said, okay, you can't marry your siblings. You know, Abraham married his half-sister. And so that is becoming increasingly dangerous today, because this is a problem for evolutionists. They think we get better and better and better over millions of years, but we know over just thousands of years in the animal kingdom and in the, among humans, we have this increasing problem of mutations, and nobody wants their kid to have a mutation. And if evolution were true, all parents would be praying for mutations.
That's right. But over time, slowly, the human population is deteriorating, actually, because the genetic load is increasing. Now, some of the mutation rates are not accurate, because they base those off of comparing us to chimps and assume we're related.
Right,
and so
right.
They come up with a mutation rate. But we do know that there's deterioration going on, and it leads to problems like this and why we can't have close relation, you know, marriages.
Right, exactly, as Scripture tells us. So, Fred Williams, what a pleasure to do Real Science Friday with you. We were speaking through this Creation magazine from creationontheweb.com. And if you'd like to see Fred's website, it's evolutionfairytale.com. And Fred is a speaker in the Denver area, has fabulous presentations, PowerPoint. Get him at your church, your youth group, just whatever collection of folks he'd come and speak. So you can reach him at his website, evolutionfairytale.com. And tomorrow is the March for Life in Colorado at the Capitol at 1:30. And you are going to want to be there. What a fabulous speaker, Julie Malcoma. She's coming in from out of state. And it's at 1:30 on the steps of the Capitol, downtown Denver, Saturday, January 19th. Please come out. I will be there. In fact, so many people you've heard on this show over the years will be at the March for Life tomorrow at 1:30. And if you'd like to get Creation Magazine, you can make a donation to Bob Inert Live, $50 or more, or get our science pack for $100. And we'll send you a gift subscription to Creation. Maranatha Christian Center in Arvada. What a great school, Maranatha.